Welcome to History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast featuring the world's leading historians answering the big questions, hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
In the American Declaration of Independence, the Founding Fathers labelled King George III an absolute despot. They accused him of having plundered their seas, ravaged their coast, burnt their towns, and destroyed the lives of their people. That set the tone. He has since been branded idle, a brute, the cruelest tyrant of the age, and even one of England's most disastrous kings. Andrew Roberts, who is with me today, could not disagree more. In his work, George III, The Life and Reign of Britain's Most Misunderstood Monarch, he says George is the most unfairly treated sovereign in the long history of the British monarchy. He was not only a good king, says Andrew Roberts, but a good man too. It was certainly a tumultuous reign, featuring the American Revolutionary War, the threat of Napoleon, and the king's troubles with what we now know was mental illness. In his latest work, Andrew Roberts, biographer of Churchill and Napoleon, considers the life of George from a humane, fair perspective. With access to previously unstudied papers, he casts one of Britain's most important monarchs in a fresh light, as someone to be admired rather than despised. Andrew, welcome. You describe George III as Britain's most misunderstood monarch. Where did this misunderstanding come from, and how has it influenced our view of the king today?
I think the misunderstanding really started pretty much whilst he was still king. The Whigs, especially the radical Whigs, hated him. Mm-hmm. And they, for some reason, really have provided the historians throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century even, up until the 1930s. And so he had a terrible rap, basically, from history, and it has completely affected the way that we see him today.
Tell us something about the Whigs and the Whigs and the Whig and Whig history. I think we sort of need to know a little bit about that to understand also how this fits in.
Well, the Whigs were really the great force behind the bloodless and glorious revolution of 1688 that effectively brought the Hanoverians ultimately to the throne. And so he had a lot to thank the Whigs for. His grandfather and his great-grandfather were very much in the pocket of the Whigs, these extremely rich, titled, aristocratic, and in many ways very splendid and patriotic Protestants who brought down James II. But they had been in complete control, this sort of oligarchy of a few families, of British politics for 70, 80 years by the time that George III came to the throne. And he frankly wanted to have a completely different way of looking at politics. He wanted to be able to choose the best people rather than people who had Whig ideology. He wanted to be able to choose people of no party. He wanted to be able to choose the occasional Tory. He was a revolutionary himself in that sense.
So there's a power play going on, one can say. And you say he's a Hanoverian king. What do we mean by that? And what do we need to know about the Hanoverians and how they're viewed by historians?
Well, they were the royal family from 1714 onwards, and they were in control in that, although they, of course, had constitutional powers, they also had two uprisings against them from the Stuarts, the previous regime, in 1715 and 1745. Both of those were defeated, and so they were pretty much solidly on the throne. Of course, the previous uprising had only been 15 years before George III came to the throne in 1760. So, in a sense, he had to watch out for his rebellious Scottish subjects. But in fact, they weren't rebellious by that stage. They were pretty loyal.
Can you set the stage for us? What kind of world is George III born into?
Well, it's primarily, of course, Protestant. This is the key thing. The reason that James had been overthrown was because he was a Catholic, and as well as being an obscurantist and a would-be absolutist, you know, it was a good thing that he was overthrown. Very good thing for British history, but it did mean that from his coronation oath onwards, it was really essential to George III to establish and keep established the Protestant Church. The next part of his life, I suppose, and his sort of existence was that he was at the apex of British society, and it was a very agricultural society. About 80% of people in Britain took their livelihoods from the land in some way, which was one of the reasons that he took a great deal of interest in agriculture. He was nicknamed Farmer George and wrote articles, anonymous articles for agricultural magazines. You don't get the Industrial Revolution really until the 1780s, which is quite well on into his reign.
Why did you decide to write this book? Because I think we will come back a bit to sort of his world again and the source materials you've been using. But first of all, why George III?
Well, he has been, as I point out in the subtitle about being Britain's most misunderstood monarch, he has been wildly underestimated, I think, by history. We've had this Whig analysis that he was a tyrant, that he was obstinate, that even some people think that he was so mad that he wound up losing the American colonies. That was simply not the case. You know, he did not have an attack of his what was called the King's Malady between 1765 and 1788, and of course we lost the American colonies between 1775 and 1782. So it just simply can't have been the case chronologically, and that's only a couple of the huge misunderstandings about this man.
But you've also been using there's been virgin territory in a sense in terms of source materials. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, there was one good biography written by Jeremy Black in 2006. But other than that, there hasn't been a cradle to the grave life of George III in half a century. And very fortunately, the Queen in 2015 put George III's private papers into something called the Georgian Papers Programme, which was run from King's College, is being run indeed, from King's College London. It's a brilliant and wonderful thing whereby they are putting all of the most important documents about George III, some 100,000 pages of them, online.
So when you went through this material, what was the most surprising thing you found in the sources?
I think the most surprising thing was when he was Prince of Wales in the 1750s. Unfortunately, we don't have the actual date on the document. He wrote an essay for his tutor saying that he thought that slavery was an execration, that it was a ludicrous concept, that all the arguments made in favour of it were absurd, and he came down very much against it. Now, of course, as king, he didn't do anything, he didn't move to abolish slavery. As I mentioned earlier, he was a constitutional monarch, and there wasn't a majority in the House of Commons for doing that until 9 years after his death. But nonetheless, it was fascinating to see this, and one therefore understands why he never bought or sold a slave in his life, never owned a slave, never invested in the companies that bought and sold slaves and so on. So and of course signed the legislation abolishing the slave trade. So you have, especially at this time when we are so conscious of the whole argument about slavery, somebody who actually, within his own confines of national interest and realpolitik, was a relatively good guy.
Well, and it's interesting to say that he was a good guy, because you paint a very convincing portrait of sort of his character. It's a psychological portrait in many ways. And since that is what it is, let's go back to sort of like Freud would suggest. We'd need to go back to his childhood. So can you tell us about his early years?
Well, I think Freud would have a lot of fun with this. I mean, it was very, very weird and strange and indeed Freudian. In fact, Freud crops up almost immediately when it looks like, you remember that tutor that I mentioned earlier in the last question, the third Earl of Bute? He was supposedly having an affair with George's mother, and which actually wasn't the case, but everybody believed it to be, which was terrible. He also had a good relations, very good relationship with his own father, Frederick, Prince of Wales, who tragically died when George was 12. He then had a terrible relationship with his grandfather. In fact, there's a terrible story of how his grandfather refused to bury his father for a fortnight, and so he had to actually live in the room directly below the putrefying body, the decomposing corpse of his own father. Yes, I think Freud would have fun with that, don't you? Yes, it was a pretty traumatic upbringing.
And it seems to be a pattern with the Hanoverians. They have very complicated family relations.
They have intergenerational loathing, frankly, which George III broke out of because, as I say, he loved his father and his father loved him. But, you know, his father died when he was 12, so he wasn't able to truly get to know him.
I think his education is important because if we want to understand what he's doing later in life. So say something about, first of all, I mean, he's privately taught. He doesn't go to school with other children.
No, he doesn't. He hardly ever sees other children. He's other sort of children of courtiers he will be able to befriend, including, fascinatingly, Lord North, who becomes his Prime Minister for 12 years during the American War of Independence, and a completely disastrous one. He is, according to the Whig historians, he's thick. He's slow on the uptake, very bad at pretty much everything. This is not true at all. It's perfectly possible now to see from the essays that he wrote and from the fact that he was able to speak several languages and he was writing in Latin and so on, that he was a perfectly intelligent young lad and not at all the Dimmy Dumbo that he was made out to be later.
And, you know, the quotes you have in your book, I must say, it looks quite impressive. Very few students today at that age would produce that kind of scholarship.
Well, I'm not sure that many students of today are as clever as the students of 200 years ago anyway. You know, I mean, I don't know how good your Greek and Latin is, Matthias.
No. Well, it wasn't all bad when I studied it.
No, of course, it's relatively speaking. Yeah. And relatively speaking, he had a fine, enlightened education, a really good upbringing in that it wasn't just Latin and Greek. He also had lessons in, dancing and fencing.
Yes.
And he had one of the greatest architectural historians, Sir William Chambers, who taught him drawing. He was a very accomplished draftsman, in fact. And so you do get this chap who, by the time he comes king, he's a real Renaissance man, you know. Mm. And this, again, is something that is just written out of the Whig histories.
Yes, and I was thinking the quote. You talked about his view on slavery. So this is interesting. That do we know when he wrote it?
Because unfortunately, not. No, all we know is it's in the 1750s. It's sometimes you can tell from these essays about where they physically are in the in the pile of papers, but that's not possible on this occasion either, unfortunately, in the file. And I think it's very important to say, you know, yes, he obviously opposed slavery when he was Prince of Wales, but he did not do anything to try to abolish it when he was King of England. Partly this is because of his constitutional beliefs, but also, of course, we took about a third of British revenues from the West Indies. And nobody was able to work out an economic model whereby the West Indies could be successful sugar producers and tobacco producers and so on without slavery. And so, you know, this has to be a stain on his escutcheon, because obviously slavery was the most appalling evil for centuries.
We'll come back to that when we talk about America. And, of course, he's the last king of America, one can say. But keeping to his sort of personal life, and because I find it interesting, with this sort of Renaissance education, and he becomes a sort of a Renaissance king, he's also partly known for his sort of scandalous family.
So
who were they? Given you know who he is,
he himself was not at all scandalous. He is the one Hanoverian monarch who loved his wife, was faithful to his wife, was utterly uxorious, was a good parent and a kind, you know, father to his children. However, his uncles, his brothers, and his sons were all the most extraordinary bunch of scandal-ridden rakes. One of his sons had 10 illegitimate children. They very often, I think there was a bigamist at one point, they were constantly having the most outrageous love lives, and their financial lives were terrible as well. They were all deeply mired in debt, and in a sense, this was.
And it's fantastic numbers when you look at how indebted they are.
Huge amounts, yeah. His son Prinny, the Prince of Wales, later King George IV, was spending. He was the sort of Imelda Marcos of the 18th century. He was spending huge sums on his palaces, on his coaches, on himself, on his art, and so on, to the extent that he was almost spending as much as the whole nation was spending on the Royal Navy at one point. And this is, you know, this is what's called the reversionary interest, because the supporters and the people who would lend money to the Prince of Wales knew that one day it would get paid back with interest when the Prince of Wales became king.
So how did public opinion sort of view this?
They hated it. They thought it was outrageous. And unfortunately, they blamed a lot of it on George III rather than on the people who actually racked up the debts themselves. You know, you'd have a royal, you know, prince of the blood going into Brooks's club or Almack's club, one of the great gambling sort of dens of the day, and blowing the equivalent of entire, you know, bishoprics on the turn of a card. And this was blamed totally unfairly on George III, who was disgusted by this behaviour, who did not gamble and, you know, he enjoyed the odd horse race, but he was not he was frugal, in fact, with his money. And he occasionally had to sort of buy out. There's one occasion where he bought out Prinny's love letters when she was being blackmailed by one of his mistresses. You know, that's how he was forced to spend his money. He'd have much preferred to have spent it on augmenting his wonderful library of books at Buckingham House.
Was George III interested in politics?
Yes, absolutely. Well, you couldn't be a King of England really at that stage without being interested in it. But as I say, he wasn't ideological. He very much approached every issue in with an open mind. And he wanted, as I said earlier, the best people to be placed in the right positions in government. He was the last monarch who worked directly with cabinet ministers and not through a prime minister. But there's only one occasion when he appointed a prime minister who didn't have the support of the House of Commons. So he was constituted, and there's a very good reason for that. The Whigs were trying to nationalise the East India Company, and it would have given them inordinate power if they'd managed to pull that off. And so he appointed William Pitt the Younger, who subsequently won a landslide victory in the next general election. So it wasn't that unconstitutional to do what he did. Otherwise, he very much revered the Constitution, you know, which is not surprising considering it did give him, you know, large powers. The Harvard Law Review this year has equated those powers to that of the American president, but slightly less than the American president has today.
Most people who encounter, you know, George III today, I suppose it's through the musical Hamilton. and can you explain how your portrayal of George corrects this view?
Yes, very much. I loved Hamilton. I really enjoyed it. It was great. The show-stopping numbers, you know, they were songs that you know, hum later. But historically, they were completely wrong. They make him out to be a cruel and vicious figure who, you know, will kill your family to remind you of my love, that great line, which could not be more wrong. You know, he was actually, it's impossible. You go through his entire archive and in vain looking for any plans to sort of subjugate or tyrannize the American people. All he did was to exercise the same constitutional rights and duties that he had, that all kings of England had for 150 years in America.
Can you run us through the sort of his relationship to America, the way he viewed America as a colony, and also sort of the build up towards the American Declaration of Independence and his role in that, or I mean, as a
yes, he very much felt that it was. It was right that the Americans should contribute something, not a lot, not a, in fact an absolutely tiny amount, but something to their own defence from the Native Americans in the West after the what's called the French and Indians Wars there, what we call the Seven Years' War over here, which ended in 1763. So he was in favour initially of the Stamp Act, which in 1765 was inaugurated in Britain in order to try to offset some of the costs of a British army on the west side of the 13 colonies. And to just give you a sense, the amount it was intended to raise was between 40 and 60,000 pounds, and there were at that stage 2.5 million Americans, of whom 600,000 were enslaved people. So you have 1.9 million free people, and if you divide 50,000 pounds by 1.9 million, you wind up at 26 a quarter of a pound, basically, 5 shillings per person, per American, per year. Mm. You know, an absolutely tiny amount considering what they were getting for that. However, it was enough to make a country that was, or should I say, not a country yet, of course, a series of colonies, that was ready for independence, use the tax issue to gain that independence. And it's perfectly understandable that they do that. They were ready by the 17, certainly once the French threat had been totally removed at the end of the Seven Years' War in 1763, the Americans were ready. They had a population, as I mentioned, that was quite big. They had an economy that was booming like crazy. They had an advanced society and one that could easily survive as an independent nation, as we see. Mm. So they had every right to try to get their own sovereignty. And in many ways, you know, they're all the more exceptional for it, for the way that they go about it, because they're not being tyrannized.
Yes.
You know, they have a they're one of the freest societies in the world in the 1760s. You can look up around the rest of the world, especially in Europe, and see the iron hand of the state is everywhere. Whereas in George III's America, he only had 17 officials in Virginia. I think there were even fewer in some of the other states. It was not in any sense a sort of tyranny. He didn't have armed forces on the ground. He didn't have, except for in Boston later on, he didn't close down newspapers, arrest editors, stop the Continental Congress or the Stamp Act Congress from meeting, any of these kind of things that, frankly, the French or the Austrians or the Russians would have done.
And I think you also have, many quite convincing arguments that he's firmly against this kind of tyrannical rule that you see almost everywhere in Europe at the time. And for example, he reacts to the coup by Gustav III in Sweden.
He denounced that.
Yes.
He thought that that was the way that precisely the way that a king should not behave.
Yes.
And yet he's constantly criticised by the Whigs, by Edmund Burke and other radical Whigs, for wanting to do this. You know, they become totally paranoid, frankly, about the idea that the king is trying to extend powers, which he simply isn't, and it's possible to see that now.
You do detailed analysis of the American Declaration of Independence. So what did you discover when you did that? What did surprise you?
Well, I found the whole thing surprising, really. I hadn't read it since university. Of course, there are those first two opening paragraphs, which are some of the most beautiful language in politics. You know, I mean, they're still, after all this time, you know, nearly 2.5 centuries, incredibly moving and powerful evocations of human freedom. They're just a wonderful Shakespearean language. But then you come on to the second section, which comprises some 28 different charges that are made, very personal, very ad hominem charges that are made against George III. And only two of them, the 17th, which is about taxes, and the 22nd, which is about lawmaking, only two of them hold water. The rest of them are either ex post facto rationalisations of an independence movement that had already begun. Remember, the first shots were fired in April 1775, and it's not until the July of 1776 that the Declaration of Independence is promulgated. So you have a series of either complaints about that would be true of every single one of his 9 predecessors since Elizabeth I, or things that are complaining and declaring independence against him because of things that only happened after they had originally started the revolt. So really, there are only two, in my view, and some of them are just legally completely ridiculous, and there are only two of them that hold water. But the key thing is that those two, the 17th and the 22nd, hold so much water that they do justify the American Revolution.
I see. And what is George III's reaction to losing America?
It's not as bad as one would think, in fact. He was able to meet John Adams when John Adams came over to London as ambassador in June 1785 and treated him extremely well and courteously and had the exact words are in my book. I can't remember them off by heart, but he's extremely polite and good-natured. And then when George Washington gave up the presidency in March 1797, he said that he was the greatest character of the age. This is quite a positive thing to say about somebody who defeated your armies and threw you out off the American North American continent. From Canada.
But you make a point that had he been more tyrannical, he could actually have won the war.
He was accused, obviously, all the way through the Declaration of Independence of being a tyrant, but actually a true tyrant, a tyrant like Catherine the Great, who slaughtered 50,000 Russians in the Pugachev uprising, or several other of the European monarchs of the day. They would have used methods to try to crush the American rebellion. And remember, there is no country in the world at that stage that would just let 13 colonies simply secede. I mean, you don't get that until the 20th century, indeed in your country, 1905, when Norway and Sweden split. Yep. And that's the first time in history that such a thing has happened without bloodshed. And so you have very much this sense that were he this evil, sinister, vicious tyrant, he would have done things like armed the slaves in South Carolina or given significant arms to the Native Americans and encouraged them to attack the 13 colonies, and would have created a sort of appalling social revolution that would have led to enormous amounts of bloodshed. And instead, he did none of those things.
If Hamilton has now sort of set the tone for the way we view Your Third Today. Of course, Alan Bennett's play and then the film, The Madness of George III, that was sort of another. Well, at least for me, I saw the film in 1994, I suppose, when it came out, and formed my way of looking at his illness and his madness, and they talked about this disease called porphyria. You'd explained this as a misdiagnosis. So could you describe his madness and what caused it?
Yes, the porphyria thesis was put forward in the late 1960s by a mother and son medical duo called Doctors McAlpine and Hunter. And it turns out, rather shockingly, that they used, frankly, intellectually dishonest a methodology. They only gave the doctors who they consulted a very small number of symptoms, and only the symptoms that were likely to produce a porphyria result, which porphyria is a physiological illness rather than a psychiatric illness, which is what he genuinely had. He had manic depression, the bipolar form of manic depression. And so it's for literally half a century, it wasn't until 2010 that doctors had a look again at the, historical doctors, as it were, you know, people who were writing in historical journals, had a look again at the methodology of back in the 60s and realised that it was fatally flawed. I'm afraid, but quite a lot of this is to do with urine and faeces and the colour of them and the way in which that they, under porphyria, they go a bluish purple colour, hence the name porphyria. And that happened on only a very small number of occasions, and there are perfectly reasonable non-porphyria explanations for them, such as the gentium that was given to the king as a medicine, the fact he ate beetroot and so on.
It's also sometimes misinterpretations of the historical record. So there's blue, and it's supposed to be in between.
That's right. The word between is quoted by McAlpine and Hunter, whereas when you go to the original source, it clearly is not that. It's an entirely different word, and these are. These are, you know, pretty bad things to have done. They obviously so desired to get this, and they had a belief that there were no such things as psychiatric illnesses, that all illness was physical, was chemical, ultimately. Mm. And so we now know, half a century later, after having gone down this sort of, you know, rabbit hole, which Nicholas Heitner and Alan Bennett and others perfectly understandably, followed when they made their very enjoyable play and TV show.
How did his illness affect his reign?
Well, it destroyed it in the end. In 1810, when he had the last of his five attacks, most historians only claim four, but I'm absolutely certain that the one in 1765 was what's called a prodrome of his illness. And most historians they certainly agree on the four. The first four of them only lasted together about a year, but then the last one lasted 10 years. So he was completely mad from 1810 to 1820 when he died, and his son Prinny became George IV, became Prince Regent, and was to all intents and purposes he had all the powers of the king.
And what were the symptoms? So he's manic.
He would talk endlessly, sometimes for 24 hours, non-stop. He would rush about. He would sometimes get physically abusive and violent. He would swear. He would talk. He would talk very, very quickly.
A bit indecent as well.
Swear. He came under under the impression that he was having an affair with the Countess of Pembroke, which is very sad. And ultimately, it destroyed his marriage. Not the affair, because that never happened. That was entirely in his own mind. But the fact that Queen Charlotte, who was a delightful and sweet natured and intelligent woman, just obviously couldn't continue by 1804 to share a bed with somebody who was, you know, likely at any moment to go mad.
Was his illness described at a time by journalists or writers or?
Yes, and very unfairly, in fact, because people who actually had no personal knowledge would make things up and would sell pamphlets about the king's madness that that are entirely invented. There's there's no substantiated source for the story that he went up and talked to a tree in Windsor Great Park under the impression that it was Frederick the Great. Frederick the Great, who was dead by then anyhow. But, you know, this became part of the sort of folklore.
Your account of George III, he comes across as extraordinarily likable, I must say.
Yes, he was, wasn't he? He was Fanny Burney, the writer who became one of the Queen's ladies in waiting, really admired him and loved conversations with him, and they talked about all sorts of things, highly intellectual things as well, as sort of, you know, court gossip and so on. And of course, he has this long conversation with both Boswell and Johnson separately. He invited people to Windsor Castle, great intellectuals of the day. He was a deeply, deeply cultured man. And so, yes, I think it must have been great fun to have been in his court.
I would like to end on him as an Enlightenment ruler, because he's not typical. He's quite religious and also is conservative in many ways. Could you describe his style?
Yes. You're quite right. He was religious. He was pious in the right sense of that word. He could be a bit self-righteous. I think if one is going to look at his faults, one would say he's self-righteous. He wasn't at all interested in travel. He never went north of Worcester, never visited Ireland or Hanover or America, of course. So there are drawbacks to him, undoubtedly. This is not intended to be a hagiography. This is very much a sort of rounded view of the man, and he did make political mistakes as well. But overall, he was a good person. And we mentioned earlier about his culture. You know, he bought the 80,000 books that form the nucleus of the British Library. He founded the Royal Academy. He had the largest collection of scientific instruments in the world. He bought half of what is today the Royal Collection, which is the largest private art collection in the world. He had the planet Uranus named after him. He helped build the biggest telescope in the world. You know, he was very interested in astronomy and so on. This is a proper Renaissance figure who, historically, I'm afraid, has been written off as a fool and a loser and a sort of madman.
If we were a monarch today, would it be popular, you think?
I think so too, very much, yes. Because I see a lot of the modern monarchy in George III. I see in Her Majesty the Queen the same sense of duty, the pious Christianity, the same abstemiousness in food and drink, frugal financially, somebody who is hardworking and very much, you know, people think that the modern monarchy derives from Queen Victoria, but actually I think that George III, Queen Victoria's grandfather, has a lot to say. He's the first one who buys Buckingham Palace, of course, invents the Royal Walkabout, goes to builds the road to Ascot. There are lots of parts of the modern monarchy which derive from George III rather than Queen Victoria.
Andrew Roberts, thank you very much.
History Lessons is a podcast from the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.